together. He followed me back then. The box outside my house. Who else could have left that? Over a decade ago, but she still remembered the pretty box, the satin ribbon, her heart-stopping fear as she opened it. Her relief when she had found it was empty. But it had been a warning. She peered out at the people moving along the street past her car. Was he out there, watching her, hidden in the shadows? He doesn't know where you live. You've moved since then, haven't you? Yes. How could she have stayed at her old place with those memories surrounding her like ghosts? I've got your number now. I've got to go. It's intense here. He paused. I'll call you as soon as I hear anything. As the call ended, it occurred to her that she had moved, but her mother had lived in the same house since before Kira was born. If the killer had followed Kira to her apartment back then, might he have also followed her to her mother's house? Might he know where to find them? Call Mum, Kira commanded. Through the comset at her ear, she could hear her mother's staggered breath down the line. She already knew. You okay, Mum? Yes. Don't let Molly know yet. Kira put her thumb to the ignition and the engine fired up. I'll be there as soon as I can. She pulled away from the pavement, knowing her only passenger on the drive would be the awful memories of what the Mizpah murderer had done. Chapter 4. 15 years ago. Life extinct. Two drones buzzed overhead, illuminated by the blue police car lights that flashed aggressively in the dark. The peripatetic medical officer, or perimed as they were known, sat in the ambulance. He had pulled over to let Kira in through the narrow gates. As she drove past, his face was briefly lit up by his mini-screen, presumably receiving another emergency call. The windscreen appeared smeared, making his face look smudged. He gave her a brief nod as she drove through the gates. There was no need for an ambulance now. As she parked up, she could see Tom and the team working at the far end of the concourse. Her boot heels clattered across the concrete as she made her way over towards the steep dunes of plastic and metal scraps, midway through being sorted and crushed into bales. The nearby machines had been disabled by the human managers in central control and now stood like huge metal skeletons, casting angular shadows across the forecourt. The Organic Waste Recycling and Energy Recovery Centre was usually run by automated systems. It was a large, factory-like complex built around a concourse, the roofs covered in solar panels and ecological green thatch, thriving even though it was a cold winter. At the centre of the site sat 8 swimming pool-sized vats of soil and sand where the smell was strongest. The frothy scum on top glittered with a layer of silver frost. There was a platoon of police here, a number of uniformed officers controlling the gate, a crime scene photographer, and a few detectives. Nearby, the crime scene investigation team had set up lamps which cut shards of light into the late evening gloom. The CSIs dipped in and out of the surrounding darkness, looking like ghosts in their white overalls. Kira could see Dr. Helen Wilson, the medical examiner, at the heart of the action in front of her. Tom, illuminated by the lamps, rested on his haunches over where Kira assumed the body lay. They had worked together this time last year, in 2019, when the first 2 victims of the Mizpah murderer had been found. She assumed he wanted her opinion as to whether or not this was the same killer. Drawing closer, bracing herself against more than the cold February breeze, Kira could see what he was looking at. All that studying at university, the psychiatry and neuropsychopathy, the theory, even the photographs, couldn't have prepared her for the desecrated bundle that lay at her feet. At first glance, it appeared as though the woman had curled up to sleep in a fetal position, her back to them, the buttons of her spine visible through her thin, pale skin. Helen turned to greet Kira, putting her gloved hands on her ample hips as she stood up straight. Tom gave a gruff hello, eyes still on the corpse. He'd asked for Kira specifically. Did he want her opinion? The least he could do was to look at her. From this proximity, Kira caught the reek of death. She brought her mind into focus, looking for patterns, anything to help her build on her profile notes. As she stepped closer, she could see that the head had been wrapped tightly in silver duct tape, mousy hair sprouting from the top. She was naked, apart from a black biodegradable bin liner which had been wrapped around her waist and lower torso. A fine sheen of frost swirled in fern-shaped patterns across the black plastic shroud, like lace, glistening in the artificial light. Her knees were bent and her tiny feet crossed at the ankle, the soles heartbreakingly dirty like a child's called in from play. The shell-pink painted toenails gave Kira a pang of sorrow. She forced her eyes to look further. The woman had her arms raised in front of her like a boxer. Part of the bin liner had been torn away, by a fox, perhaps? She shuddered. A long winding tattoo of a snake began at the woman's shoulder, curled around her bicep, past her elbows and down to her wrist, where the snake abruptly ended, decapitated. No serpent eyes or bearing of fangs. Nothing but bloody stumps. The woman's hands had been amputated at the wrists. Kira gagged, stomach roiling, and she tore her gaze away. She took deep breaths, waiting for her body to calm, but she was compelled to look again. White shards of bone jutted out from blood that had turned black and viscous like tar. Turning to Helen, Kira asked, "Do we know cause of death yet?" Helen leaned over the body and pointed a purple plastic-gloved finger. "Likely it was asphyxiation, and if it's anything like last year, she would have been dosed up first with a strong opiate. Should show up on the toxicology report." Kira tapped her chest with a finger. "Is it the same as last time?" Helen brushed back a lock of auburn hair from her forehead with the back of her hand. "See for yourself." Kira leaned over the corpse, forcing her eyes to look at the ribcage to where Helen indicated. There was a gaping hole between the small white breasts, which was ringed with dried, blackened blood and greying skin. Kira retched. Some things could never be unseen. Helen didn't look at her but said, "You feeling okay?" Kira grunted, her hand over her mouth. "Sternum's been removed, but put back into the body after the heart was taken out." Helen probed the chest cavity with her fingers. "We'll know more once I've completed the autopsy." Kira swallowed hard. Tom asked, "Hands removed post-mortem?" Helen picked up the lower arm, brought it close to her face and studied the stump, the jagged bone protruding from the brown mess of dried blood. Kira saw Tom wince. "No, looks like prior to death, judging by coagulation. If he had wanted to remove evidence that might have been caught under the fingernails, it would have been easier to do after death. Could be torture?" "Or to make her more powerless," suggested Kira. Her anger rose as she imagined the small woman trying to defend herself. "She died elsewhere and then was dumped here. There would have been a lot of blood otherwise." "He chooses small women," Kira said. "I don't think he's a big man. He wants the upper hand physically, wants to make sure he can control them. The plastic wrapped around the torso, I don't think this is a sexually motivated murder. In fact, he's covered her up deliberately." Tom regarded her. "This looks exactly like the woman we found last February, the unknown woman, the prostitute we found at the sewage treatment works." She took a step back, away from the body. "Same time of year, same type of injuries, similar deposition site. It's him."
"Looks that way," Tom agreed.
"The perimed was the first on the scene, but it was obvious that she was already dead." Tom looked at her, his eyes glittering amongst the shadows. "We don't know who called it in." This is what Kira was trained for, to profile criminals so that they could be caught and then studied. She could scan the perpetrator's brain and analyze his psychology to try to find the root cause of this behavior,
The focus was so much on prevention these days, and how could they prevent if they didn't understand? A rapid burst of flashes shattered the darkness temporarily. The CSI photographer was already packing her equipment away in a case.
Bloody journalists!
Tom barked at two nearby officers and pointed in the direction of a man who had somehow managed to get into the compound. Kira took off her coat and held it over the body, trying to shield it, until the intruder was rugby tackled to the ground and finally manhandled away. The last thing the victim's family needed was to see an image of the gruesome damage that had been inflicted on her that could show up any time on the hypernet.
We're ready to move her now, sir,
Tony Rosen, the crime scene manager, informed Tom. Kira put her coat back on. Rowson's large, angular frame pushed against the shoulders of his overall as he stretched to unzip a body bag on a gurney. Four of the team moved around the body, like pallbearers. There was a hushed, reverential moment of stillness before Rosen counted down and they lifted her. She seemed so small as they laid her out on the white polyethylene bag. Kira estimated a little over a metre and a half. They haven't found the hands? She asked Tom.
Not yet.
The poor family, having to bury their loved one, knowing that parts of her were still missing. Or else they would find the rest of her, but that would mean... The snap as Helen pulled off one of her gloves brought Kira back.
Estimated time of death?
Judging by body temperature and lividity, I'd say 2 days. Probably died sometime on Thursday night.
It's a pattern, Kira said. Tom bobbed his head, tight-lipped. And that means only one thing, she said, not even wanting to say the words. He looked at her, his eyes merely shadows in the darkness, and finished the sentence for her. That another woman will be dead within the week. Chapter 5. Thursday, 1st of February, 2035, 7:44 p.m. It was dark when Kira drove up to her mother's house along the wide curved road between the green lawns and mature trees that had already begun to thrive, even though it was only February. The 1930s semi-detached houses were mainly owned by retirees. They were considered unaffordable to the young and enviable for their amount of space. The majority of workers, even those with families, had moved into apartments exactly like her own in the ever-expanding city, which had gradually oozed into the suburbs.
Is Molly in her room? Kira asked as she burst through the front door and into the living room. Her mother stood frozen in the centre of the floor, a blue-checked tea towel clenched in her hands, staring at David Lomax's image, which filled the screen. Her face was pale and strained. Kira moved over to her and she turned her head slightly towards her daughter and nodded, but her eyes were still glued to the news. Emma's face appeared briefly on the screen. Her public status in death reduced to that of being one of Lomax's victims, a news item. Her mother let out a moan and Kira saw her eyes, light brown like Emma's, were glassy with unshed tears. Underneath the shock, Kira knew there were 14 years of pain and anger that simmered, that took energy and courage to contain. Her mother was petite, as Emma had been, but somehow her grief made her seem smaller.
He was allowed out to go to his mother's funeral. Emma won't get to go to mine.
Her head dropped for a moment. Kira didn't reply, but swallowed hard.
Instead, I had to go to the funeral of my own child, because of him.
I'm going to stay here tonight, Kira said, putting her arm briefly around her mother's shoulders. I'll speak to Molly first, and then I'll come and look after you.
Kira took one last look at the screen, remembering Emma at 7 years old, lying on the carpet watching cartoons. Her mum nodded sadly and reluctantly. Kira turned away. She could see the dent in the door where Emma, at 14, had thrown a cup at her when they argued over a jumper. At 21, Emma was dead. Her baby sister, 7 years younger than her, would have been 35 now had she lived. Kira could see her dad sitting in his armchair, lowering his newspaper in shock as Emma told him that she was pregnant at just 17, his face falling, probably afraid at what his daughter's future held. He could never have possibly imagined. A swelling rise of guilt that she usually kept so well contained overwhelmed her. If only she had known what she knew now, she would never have let those have been the last words she had said to her sister before she had left the cafe. She would have apologized, said she was wrong, she hadn't meant it. She would have pulled at her sister's sleeves, offered little Molly another cake. Any cake you want, sweetheart, so that they'd stay. Walking through the hall and up the stairs, Kira followed a trail of photographs. Her mum and dad, a young married couple, new parents, older then, her and Emma growing up, Kira in her graduation gown, and then Molly making the transition from a rosy-faced baby to a beautiful young woman. There was no reply when she knocked, so she pushed the door open. Molly lay on the bed, facing away from her, not moving, hidden by her lilac bed cover. Kira had once shared this bedroom with Emma, and even though her mother had redecorated in pastels, with white furniture and a double bed, the ghosts were always present, like a bittersweet aroma that lingered. Their old twin beds, the late-night conversations, Dad telling them off for giggling in the dark. She sat on the bed and tentatively put her hand on her niece's back. Molly, love, I need to tell...
I know, I saw the news pops,
came her muffled reply. Had she been crying?
Do you want to talk?
No.
Kira wanted to comfort her, but there was no point in pushing it. It had to be in Molly's time and in Molly's way. Sometimes she was childlike and needy, at other times she held herself back, self-contained. Kira would just have to bide her time.
I'll be next door. Any time during the night, come and get me, if you need me.
Kira sat comforting her mother for some time before retiring to the box room, where she kept some of the things she needed when she slept over, the room that her dad had painted in shades of cream and pale yellow once he had come around to the idea of being a grandfather, the room that Molly had never slept in. By the time Molly had been born, Emma had already moved out into what her dad had referred to as a communist cesspit, with a bunch of other eco-warriors, and the boyfriend she claimed was Molly's father, but whom they never met. For all the conflict, her father had died not long after Emma, broken-hearted. As Kira cleansed her face in the mirror, she remembered the wine in the footwell of her car. Would it help to have a few glasses, get the thoughts of Lomax out of her mind before sleep? She decided against it. She was exhausted, and not long after she had climbed into bed, the border between wakefulness and sleep had been crossed, and she had slipped into her dreams. She saw blue flashing lights, felt her arms wrapped around three-year-old Molly, pale and motionless, clinging a little too hard, eyes fixed on the place where she had last seen her mother. The scene began to change, the surrounding building shrinking and turning into shades of beige and brown, the tarmac and concrete disappearing to be replaced by sand. Kira gazed at Molly, still holding her tightly, as the child began to vaporize into a cloud that was made up of her colors, her brown hair, her black coat, her golden eyes, her pale skin, all in street smudges that rose into the air as her niece disappeared in front of her like smoke from a votive candle, and her arms were left empty. The clouds of colour swarmed above her for a moment and then dropped lower and began changing form. They swirled before finally solidifying into the shape of three soldiers, one ahead of the others, their guns pointing forwards. They stopped dead as the leader raised his fist. Kira immediately recognised him as Brownrigg. He jabbed a finger and they continued to move again. The temperature rose rapidly. Kira opened her eyes, lying on her bed, on her side, one hand under the pillow. The hairs on the back of her neck stood up as she heard a noise behind her, a soft shuffling, the creak of a floorboard. Heart pounding, she slowly lifted her head and turned to face the shapes of the three soldiers moving slowly, deliberately, across her bedroom floor. Even in the darkness, the muzzles of their guns were visible, pointing towards her. The smell of sweat and desert dust filled her nose and mouth. Closing her eyes, she held her breath momentarily, not daring to move a muscle. It was a dream, wasn't it? A residual memory. She waited a few seconds, heart beating loudly in her ears, and then reopened her eyes, breathless. She was alone. AM. My agitation always quartens after the first one dies. It rids something in me. Anger, resentment, fear. It's taken me hours to come down from the rush. The release is so intense. But now I need to clear my mind. I need to prepare myself for the next part. The second one is always so different. Not messy and cathartic, but a sacrament almost. This one will belong solely to you, Elise. I made a promise to you that even though I couldn't be there, I wouldn't leave you on your own in the darkness, that I would send someone to look after you. I will keep sending them until one day when I will be there myself and we will never be apart, one from another, again. The next part is always more difficult. I have to prepare. I am still too dirty, too soiled. I'm glad that you're not here, so that you cannot see what I have become, that you have not become corrupted like me. You will always remain pure, unsullied, innocent. There is work to be done, the procedure to be followed. Everything needs to be just right. I make my way slowly through the house, turning the mirrors to the wall, moving photographs, closing doors and locking them. My hands reek of the one I left at the dump. I can still smell her sticky blood on my hands, even though there's not a mark on them. I go into the kitchen and pull the bleach from the cupboard under the sink. I unscrew the lid and pour the thick, yellow liquid over my fingers and palms. Then I swap the bottle for the scrubbing brush and scour until my hands are red raw. It's not enough. I pull a packet of salt from the cupboard above the cooker, tear it open with my teeth and pour it over my hands, rubbing them together, grinding in the grains until they burn and I can feel tears stinging in my eyes. Elise! Elise! I cry over and over again. I can never be clean enough. I'll run a bath, that's what I will do. I will fill it as high as it will go and submerge myself completely. Then, when the water is still, I will lie beneath its glassy surface and open my eyes to see what you saw, to feel what you felt, and maybe, somehow, you will know that I am ready to send you another angel. Chapter 6. 14 years ago. The armoured police response van doors flew open, and six men in riot gear and helmets and holding snub-nosed semi-automatic machine guns leaped out and charged around to the back of the row of shops. Four more men had been stationed at the front, crouched ready to pounce. The sun was still an hour or so from rising. The freezing rain fell in sheets, bouncing off the Kevlar and running in rivulets down the waterproof material of the officers' uniforms. Tom went to the bottom of the rusty metal steps that led to the flats above the shops. Next to him, Pete Donovan, the head of armed response, a silver-grey flat top, fierce ice-blue eyes and a weather-beaten face that gave nothing away, stood waiting for everyone to be in place. A split second of stillness, and then his hand signal, prompting his officers to move swiftly and quietly up the steps. The doorframe splintered as the lock shattered against the battering ram. There was an excited surge forward, gruff shouts of, "Police!" as the team diverged into the four rooms of the tiny, dank flat. Tom casually followed in their wake, hands in his coat pocket. How could he be so calm? Kira followed him up the steps, her heart hammering furiously. There was more shouting. Here, here! They'd found their quarry. They had finally caught the Mitzpah murderer, the monster who might know where her sister was. Roused by the brutal alarm of the officers' shouts, Lomax was cuffed and contained. Donovan ordered the officers to stand down, and they moved away from the hub of action, job done. There was a lull as the adrenaline fizzled out. Kira followed Tom into the dark bedroom. Two armed officers stood in the far corners, hands on their weapons, muzzles trained on their target. Tom indicated the curtains, and one of the officers ripped them open. David Lomax was a few years older than Tom, but not as in good shape. He looked shorter from this angle, but he was much broader, his belly bulging out from between his greying vest and boxer shorts. He sat on a grimy sheet, the duvet in a twist on the floor, his hands cuffed behind his back. His brown hair stuck to his pallid face. The room reeked of sweat.
"What the fuck?"
he growled as Tom stood in front of him, eyeing him calmly. "David Lomax."
"Who else?" scowled the man. "Who the fuck are you and who's this bitch?"
He eyeballed Kira, and she had to force herself to stand her ground. She wanted to scream, "Did you take my sister?" But she had been warned by Tom. Her training had taught her that Lomax was the sort of criminal who would enjoy her pain, taunt her about where her sister was if he knew. The police weren't sure. Emma didn't exactly fit the pattern. Had it been the Mitzpah murderer who had dragged her into his car 2 weeks ago? What had Kira expected when she had climbed those metal stairs? That Emma would be there, locked in a room, distressed and exhausted, but still alive? They knew his pattern now. The first victim each year killed at midnight on a Thursday in February. The second woman would be killed at midnight on the following Wednesday. This was the third year of his cycle. They had already found Amelia Brigham, a Type B victim, a young social worker, in the underground reservoir near China Bank a few days ago. If Lomax had taken Emma, Kira knew she would already be dead. He would have fulfilled his pattern. It was just that they hadn't found her body yet. The thought of her sister lying somewhere, desecrated, broke her. She shouldn't even be here. This was personal. Any officer who was in any way connected with the case could be immediately taken off as protocol. Tom had been furious when she had shown up. He had warned her not to come when he called her to tell her that they were arresting Lomax. But when he had seen her at the bottom of the steps by the flat, he hadn't told her to go home. Because she was the only psychologist attached to the case? Or because of his feelings for her? Tom spoke calmly. "David Lomax, I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention, when questioned, something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence."
"I ain't done nothing," snarled Lomax, wrenching his cuffs.
Then his body stilled.
"Murder?"
he repeated, as though he didn't really understand the word. Kira studied his face as he tried to make sense of the charge. She had to restrain herself from begging for the information. He would enjoy that.
"Arresting me?"
This incensed him. He fought to get up.
"What the fuck is this? Get these things off me."
One of the armed police flung him back down on the bed.
"Shut it."
He struggled to sit up again, spittle flying from his mouth. "You have a temper on you, Lomax," Tom said pleasantly. One of the armed police came back in. "Sir, the search team are outside." "Send them in," Tom said, keeping his eyes focused on Lomax. Why wasn't Tom asking about Emma? Tom sat down on a small set of drawers near the bed, so he was almost level with the sweating man in front of him. He spoke in a quiet, gentle voice, in control. "A few days ago, a woman, Rachel Malloy,
came to speak to us, Tom said. She told us that you beat her.
Never heard of her, Lomax said, looking out of the window.
Was he trying to mirror Tom's calmness?
Only she says you do know her. She says you've been to buy her services a number of times. Regular was the word she used. It's not illegal.
It is if you don't use the designated sex industry houses.
If the stupid bitch wants to let me fuck her for a few quid, who's getting hurt?
Obviously she is, judging by her injuries, Tom said. Kira's blood was boiling now.
Get on with it, Tom. Ask him about Emma.
Lomax laughed slowly, mockingly.
Is that what this is about? Me roughing up a whore?
He looked around at the other police officers in the room, smiling.
This is bullshit.
He scowled again.
Whores get beaten up all the time. Haven't you got any proper crimes to deal with?
As I said, I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder. Tom put his hands in his pockets.
Don't know nothing about a murder. It weren't me. Rachel's old man probably done her in when she got home because he found out how she makes her money.
He grinned, showing his brown, tombstone-like teeth.
Ah, but Rachel's still very much alive, said Tom, which means she'll be able to testify against you. She won't do that, he sneered, if she knows what's good for her. How long do you think I'd get for beating up a whore?
6 months, max.
I know where she lives. It won't even get to court.
It was Tom's turn to smile now. Kira watched as he waited until Lomax's face fell.
How can you arrest me for murder when she's still alive?
There was an edge of concern in his voice.
What the fuck is this about?
Kira, can you tell the search team to make a start? We won't be here much longer.
Why was he sending her out? Was he going to ask if Emma was still alive?
If Lomax wasn't going to talk, maybe the search team would uncover a clue as to where her sister was.
Tom, please, ask him.
Lomax studied her, curious.
Search team, Tom commanded, eyes locked on Lomax as she huffed and left the room.
She gave the thumbs up and a steady stream of officers in white overalls, blue plastic over their shoes, invaded the flat and began to tear it apart, lifting greasy cushions and emptying chaotic cupboards. They used handheld metal detectors and X-ray cameras on the furniture, walls and floor. She was surprised at the state of the place. She had told the investigating team that he would be a highly organised killer and they were invariably meticulous. That would be another reason for them to scoff at her. She stood in the hall but leaned on the bedroom doorpost, watching Lomax and listening to Tom.
We took samples from Rachel Malloy, Lomax. She said you bit her.
We took DNA from the bite mark and other parts of her body. Tom left that one hanging for a moment.
Problem is, you see, he said, leaning towards Lomax. The DNA that was found on Rachel's body is already on our database. Then it ain't mine. I've never had my DNA taken, so it ain't fucking me.
His expression was one of weariness.
No, that DNA was found on two bodies. Two women who turned up dead, Tom said flatly, watching for his reaction.
The word dead made Kira's stomach clench. Lomax's eyes, bloodshot and bulging slightly, fixed on her.
It ain't me, I'm telling you. You got the wrong man. I like fighting and fucking. I've never killed no one.
You mean you've never been caught? Kira said.
That Rachel bitch is lying,
Lomax burst out, but there were beads of sweat on his brow and a nervous tick had started up in the corner of his eye. What was he afraid of? Being caught or being blamed for something he hadn't done?
We have CCTV showing you meeting Rachel on the night. Your face is very clear on the footage, Tom added.
Lomax sighed heavily.
We'll show it to you when you get to the station, after we've taken a sample of your DNA to match up with a sample from Rachel.
Kira was starting to feel lightheaded.
The small flat was full of people moving around noisily, lifting and carrying things out down the steps to the vans below. The smell of damp and the cloying heat of the radiators made her feel smothered. Being so close to Lomax was making her blood itch.
"Where's my sister, you evil bastard?"
"But we've got you now, Lomax."
Tom's voice was so low he was almost whispering.
"We're going to take you down to the station, take a biosample, and we're going to prove you committed those murders. You'll never see the light of day again."
Tom stared him out for a few moments.
"But you can make things easier on yourself. Tell us where Emma Sullivan is."
Lomax's eyes narrowed.
"Who?" "Emma Sullivan, the woman you abducted 2 weeks ago on Lawson Street."
The room seemed to shrink. Everyone else seemed to disappear. The only sound, Kira's heart beating so loudly she thought her chest might burst. After what felt like minutes, Lomax snarled,
"I told you, I ain't done nothing."
All of a sudden, all the noises, movements, people, smells came crashing in on Kira. She rushed towards Lomax with her fists flailing.
"Where is she, you bastard?"
"Get her out," Tom shouted. One of the officers grabbed her around the waist and pulled her into the hall before blocking the entrance to the bedroom. She stamped her foot in frustration. The hallway was so small that she had to squeeze back against the wall to let other officers past as they fetched and bagged items. She watched as her mini-screen, wrapped in her transparent bag, was carried out of the flat and down the steps to the van. Would there be any evidence that her sister had been there? She heard Tom say, "Cover him up." Then he came out, followed by Lomax, who was wearing joggers and sports sandals, a jacket thrown over his shoulders, an officer in front and one behind him. As he moved past her, she could see that he was much bigger than he had seemed on the bed. He suddenly lunged towards her and she cowered, but he stopped short and swore in her face. Furious with herself for showing fear, she stood up straight and put her hands on her hips. Two of the guards grappled with him, and he struggled against them as they made their way to the front door in a tangled trio. Tom was ahead, about to make his way down the steps, when someone in the living room cried out,
"Sir!"
One of the female CSIs, white hood pulled over her hair, only her dark brown eyes visible above her face mask, came out of the living room. She was on the other side of Lomax and the officers, and the lack of space meant she couldn't get close to Tom. Instead, she stretched out, almost touching Lomax's chest with her blue-gloved hand, a silver chain with a pendant dangling from her index finger. It was a half-heart of a mitzvah pendant. That was it, the last piece of the jigsaw. Tom's eyes lit up. "Found it down the back of the sofa, sir."
"Good work. Bag and tag it."
He locked gaze with Lomax for a moment and smiled contentedly. Kira studied Lomax's face, watching his confusion as he examined the necklace without recognition until the penny finally dropped. A cold, prickling sensation swam in Kira's stomach as she resented the wisp of doubt that was creeping into her mind. It all seemed so straightforward, so why was she beginning to doubt it? Lomax momentarily locked eyes with her, his expression horrified.
"No." He shook his head. "No!" he shouted louder, eyes wide, panicked now. "It weren't me! It weren't me! You think I'm some fucking psycho, butchers women?"
He began to jerk around, agitated, struggling against his handcuffs. The officers grabbed his thick-set arms and tried to restrain him, but he fought against them. Kira moved out of the front door for safety.
"It weren't me! I ain't going down for this! There's been a mistake! Rachel fucking stitched me up. I ain't going to prison."
Lomax yelled, lashing out with his feet into the scrum of officers. A few of the neighbours had come out to see what the police vans were for. Kira moved down to the bottom of the steps. Even from this perspective, she could see Lomax charging like an enraged bull into the officer in front of him and then kick out at his knees, one of which bent at a weird angle, and the copper went down yelping in pain. Then he headbutted the other officer, who slumped to the floor, face a bloody mess. The icy rain was coming down in sheets as Kira ran over to one of the vans and banged on the door to get some backup. She turned back to angry shouts as Lomax, hands still cuffed behind his back, bulldozed Tom at the top of the steps. The back doors of the van opened and two of the officers jumped out and followed Kira's eyeline. Tom, taller than Lomax, but not as well built, was pushing against him, trying to stop his escape. Lomax had lost his jacket and his vest had been torn away. His chest was drenched. The two men struggled for a few moments at the top of the stairs before Lomax gave one final push with his shoulder, hands still cuffed behind his back. Tom tried to grab the railing, but it was slick with rain, and he went toppling down the metal stairs until he hit the concrete at the bottom and lay motionless. Lomax charged down after him. Kira wasn't sure if he was going to run or attack Tom again, but as soon as he reached the bottom, five coppers were on top of him, and he lay sprawled out, taking vicious punches. He looked up amidst the beating and saw Kira staring at him.
"I'm gonna kill you, you fucking bitch!" he yelled.
Kira, shaking and legs weak, collapsed on the ground next to Tom as the blood from his head mingled with the pool of rainwater in which he lay. Chapter 7. Friday, 2nd of February, 2035. 7:32 a.m. The bus judders to a halt. The rumbling heat moving through my body, bringing a surge of nausea. I adjust my expression to copy the one of bored indifference that I often observe on the other passengers, even though my heart is beating 10 to the dozen with anticipation. The others probably think I'm off to work, but most people don't even see me, except some of the mothers with little ones. They draw away from me, almost as if they sense there is something to be feared, but can't exactly put their finger on it. Instinct. The moment she steps on board, all my anxiety disappears, replaced by a lightness of being. She swipes her comms watch on the pad by the driver and then moves down the aisle. I lower my eyes, watching her in my peripheral vision. She usually sits in the middle of the bus, to the left, if there is a free seat. It took me a few trips to get her pattern, but today she moves up close, her pale, delicate fingers catching the pole nearby to steady herself as the bus pulls off. So close. Then she sits down right in front of me. From the moment I saw her, I knew this one was the perfect offering. Yes, this one will diminish the darkness, the loneliness, the fear. I lean my head against the window and half close my eyes, adrenaline and joy moving through my body. I breathe in her scent, light and playful, roses and jasmine. She wears her gleaming fair hair in a loose bun, a long pale tendril of it spilling over the collar of her coat. My fingers twitch as I resist the urge to reach out and touch it. She reaches up and rubs the back of her neck, and I take some pleasure in thinking she might be able to feel me watching her. I came across her weeks ago, unexpectedly. Sometimes I go to her workplace and hide in plain sight. On one occasion, she smiled in my direction, but I knew she wasn't really registering me. I want so much for her to see me, but not yet. Not until the time is right. 7:45 a.m. It was always a watershed moment, finally getting home and shutting her own front door behind her. Kira had crept out before Molly and her mum had awoken, not wanting the difficult discussion about why she wasn't going to work. It was cool and dark in the flat. She usually adjusted the lights and temperature remotely via her comset before she left work. There was no point in using a timer. She had a quiet life. No partner to eat meals with, no kids needing picking up from after-school club, no cat to be fed. She had toyed with the idea so that there was another living being in the flat, but had decided it was too much of a cliché.
Part of her liked the fact that everything was exactly where she had left it, how she had left it. The window slightly open, her own breakfast dishes still in the sink, the toilet lid closed. There were never any surprises or anyone else demanding things that her exhaustion couldn't deliver. When Molly came over to stay, one night always seemed like enough. How much mess and noise could one teenager cause? Molly slept on the pull-out sofa. Having her own room would be too much of an invitation. The symmetrical block of compact apartments was identical to the other blocks along the street, and probably fairly similar inside too. She suspected they all had the same small, black, built-in, easy-clean kitchenette and the open-plan living area, which was big enough for a sofa and small table and chairs. Kira had tried to individualise her flat with a few personal items on the shelf unit, including a photograph of her dad and Emma, a tiny, crackled china vase with a shamrock design that had been her grandmother's, and a handful of non-digital books that she couldn't let go of. She made a coffee and went to the fridge to replace the milk. On closing the door, she read the digital smart message on the front. Replenish salad boxes. Eggs. Low on milk. Butter past use-by date 2 days. Remember to take daily NutriPod. Screen on, she commanded as she moved back into the living area and slumped across the sofa. An exercise program burst onto the screen, shown regularly before the news updates on the hour to try to encourage the fight against obesity. Between worrying about her mum and Molly and wondering about Lomax, sleep had evaded her the previous night. And those dreams about the soldiers. They were probably projections of her brain after the Brown Rig transference, but she might mention them to Jimmy. Shit, she still hadn't replied to his text. She'd call him tomorrow, when she wasn't so fed up. She took her comm set off her wrist, took her earpiece out, and put them on the table nearby. Kira Sullivan, job search. The screen immediately switched from programs to Hypernet search. She had saved her data from before she had met Carter, but she hadn't expected to be using it so soon. She scrolled down the results, but there was nothing exciting or unexpected. Genetics lab, research lab, child mental health psychologist, neurology clinic. None of them seemed as interesting as her last job. None appeared to allow for much creativity or independence. Certainly none of them were paying as much money as Carter had given her. With a feeling of dread, knowing what she might see, she said, "News channel." She immediately recognised the face of one of the first victims of the Mizpah murderer, Skylar Landry, the first Type B victim killed in 2019. Kira wasn't surprised the news had chosen this particular image. Skylar's slightly lopsided smile on an otherwise perfect face gave her a look of heart-rending vulnerability. Why was it that the death of a beautiful young person always seemed more tragic? Wouldn't that have been what she would have advised when working with the police? Get the most attractive photographs of the deceased, the most relatable, the most sympathy-inducing, to trigger people to help catch the monster. Kira remembered when they had found Skylar, her white dress fanned out in the water, blonde hair radiating, open eyes like pale marbles under the glassy surface, the silver mitzvah pendant around her neck. It had reminded her of a painting she had seen in the Tate, Ophelia. It was an image that would never leave her. The pond had frozen over solid, making it impossible, initially, to remove her body or examine her. The surface of the water had been like glass, Skylar's face breaking through as though a mask had been laid on top of the ice, the rest of her body visible but untouchable. Kira shook at the memory of Skylar's pale blue lips, the tips of her eyelashes covered in tiny icy beads, her small black pupils unseeing, the tops of her fingers poking out from the ice as her hands had floated, palm up. And resting on her chest, a box, brightly coloured, shocking pink, tied with an orange satin ribbon. It had been the contents of the box that had linked the two deaths,
proving the two women were killed by the same man, establishing the pattern. On her 30th birthday, in the midst of the investigation, her mother and Molly had bought Kira a special gift, one they knew she would appreciate, and presented it to her in a box with a bow. She could still see the confusion on their faces, the shock when she dropped the box and ran to the bathroom to vomit. How could she have explained to them what had been in the last box like this that she had seen? Kira's comset rang, vibrating against the wooden surface of the small table on which it lay, snapping her out of her thoughts. Her mother's face appeared on the small screen, her expression distraught, giving Kira a stab of anxiety.
"Mum, what's wrong?"
"Molly's gone."
A gasp from her mother as though she was shocked by her own words.
"Again?"
Kira flopped back onto the sofa and put her hand to her forehead. She got it. Molly was upset, but she couldn't have picked a worse time to do one of her disappearing acts.
"When?"
She focused back on her mother's face.
"I went in to wake her this morning, and her bed was empty. I'm so worried. And with him out and..."
Mum, take a moment.
The thought of her niece being out and about when Lomax was free made her stomach cold with fear. Kira watched as her mother wiped her eyes with a tissue.
"Try not to worry, Mum. She'll come back, she always does. You know what she's like. She'll be home before you know it. She's bound to have been distressed with, you know."
But her words belied her own anxiety and guilt. She should have checked on Molly before she left, but she had listened for at least half an hour through the bedroom wall as the poor girl had cried herself to sleep in the night, and she hadn't wanted to disturb her. Molly was beautiful, smart, and headstrong, but incredibly fragile. Who wouldn't be in her situation? Seeing her mother abducted, never having known her father, and then her beloved grandfather passing away. So much loss in her short life. But still, why cause more trouble?
"I've tried her comset a million times, but nothing,"
her mum said.
"Why the hell didn't I get one of Jimmy's bloody tracking chips?"
Then she would have known exactly where Molly was, could have gone straight there and given her a piece of her mind. But Molly would never have agreed to a chip. She was nearly 18. The legislature banned chipping children without their consent over the age of 12.
"She's had a shock. She just needs time to think. She'll call us soon, I'm sure of it."
Kira paused.
"I'm sorry. I should do more. She should stay with me for a while, give you a break."
Her mother's eyes were rimmed with pink, her cheeks red from crying.
"That wouldn't work," her mum sniffed. "Molly needs someone who's around all the time. You're always at work. And you have no patience."
Kira ignored this.
"She might have left for college early."
It was unlikely, knowing Molly.
"I don't really know what we can do right now, except try to ring her again. She'll come home when she's hungry or tired. Try not to lose it with her, okay? She probably needs to calm down, have a bit of headspace. When she's back, I'll come over and talk to her. There's no point in you two clashing horns again. It will only make things more difficult for you."
Some psychologist I am. I should have anticipated that Molly would have had a reaction to her mother's killer being back out in the streets. She might have only been little when her mum died, but it never goes away.
But, on reflection, she knew it was her own guilt that was blinding her.
"If it wasn't for me, Molly would still have her mother."
She pushed the thought away.
"She'll calm down once the police have got him back in custody."
Kira couldn't bear to say his name.
"She'll be back by Tuesday for Emma's anniversary, won't she?"
"Of course she will, Mum."
Kira tried to sound as confident as possible. Reassurance was what she needed.
14 years.
She watched her mum on the screen, shaking her head.
"Right then."
She took a deep breath.
"I'll call you as soon as I hear anything."
"Okay, Mum. Speak later."
As her comset screen blacked out, Kira lay back on the sofa. Her mind drifted back to the pretty gift box that had lain on the chest of Skylar Landry, the shocking pink cardboard, the orange satin ribbon pulled and placed in an evidence bag, the tension as the lid was lifted. And inside, a pair of severed hands holding a real human heart. Chapter 8. Friday the 2nd of February, 2035. 7:58 a.m. He's waiting for her at the bus stop near the hospital, almost pulls her from the step in his eagerness, wraps himself around her. He's handsome, older than her. I wonder for a moment if I've made a mistake. But then I see her face in profile, a reluctance, a wariness. She leans away from him slightly. An old man in between us is struggling to alight. I reach out my arm to guide him. He takes it gratefully. His wrinkly face smooths momentarily with a smile, reflecting my own well-practiced one. I move towards the hospital in the slipstream of people, but duck out to stand close to the couple as he corrals her outside the entrance, his face earnest. He has a few admiring looks from women passing by. It might be the uniform he wears. They probably think he's a doctor. I study my mini-screen, raising my head intermittently, pretending I'm waiting for someone so that I can listen. I shift my feet slightly. I found that if I stand too still, people notice something's not quite right. As they talk, I swipe through the photographs I have collected of her. Yoga at the well-being centre, in the gym, going to the Farmer's Arms with her friends, working at the hospital. I have been this close to her twice before, once in a queue in a shop and once when I was handing out anti-poverty leaflets in the street. I stole them from a protester so that I could get close to her. That time, I got to look in her eyes.